Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As COVID-19 spreads around the globe, governments have imposed quarantines and travel bans at an unprecedented scale. China has locked down entire cities. Italy has imposed draconian restrictions throughout the country. And in the United States, thousands of people have been subjected to legally enforceable quarantines or in self-quarantine. Businesses have been ordered to be closed, a move that will force some people into bankruptcy. Where does the legal authority stem from to take such drastic action? Even during a public health crisis? How do we hold the government accountable and make sure they don't abuse these broad and seemingly unchecked powers? What is the state of our civil liberties right now? And in an election year, how do we maintain your right to vote during a pandemic? Also, this hour, we're talking about how these rules and orders are impacting our psychological well-being. What can you do to safely mitigate the negative impacts, the stress, the worry, and loneliness of being ordered to stay at home? You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at TPRSource, and we're also on Facebook this afternoon. You can go on Facebook, see what we're doing. You can ask questions, leave comments there as well. And with us this hour, the remaining part of our hour, we're joined by Dr. Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist, stress expert, and associate executive director for practice research and policy at the American Psychological Association. Also with us is Lance Gable, a law professor at Wayne State University, internationally recognized expert on public health law and bioethics. And so, Professor Gable, let me ask you, so this is a new term for me, legal epidemiology, epi-law. What is that?
Well, we know from lots of experience that there are lots of factors that affect health outcomes and affect public health, and law is one of those factors. And so legal epidemiology is the idea that you can track how laws impact health, how different policies and implementation of laws affect health outcomes over time, that law is one of the many social and structural determinants that affect health outcomes. And so thinking of law that way allows us to consider the effects of legal policies and try to measure their impacts, and then in the future use the best evidence that we can to make sure that we're implementing laws in a way that protects health the best way we can.
So even outside of a pandemic, the law does have an impact on public health.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about all the ways that legal rules and requirements shape our healthcare systems, our access to medicines, our access to even just healthy environments that have direct impact on health outcomes. The legal infrastructure can be really important, both in the way that it's structured more broadly and in the way that it's applied during specific kinds of circumstances like we're facing right now.
So even when we talk about laws regarding vaccinations, well, how strict should those laws be? How do we make sure that the general public is vaccinated against other diseases that we still have around us, including measles, mumps, other things that need to be made sure that we don't spread?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that point is really important, especially right now. We're appropriately focusing a lot of our attention on the COVID-19 outbreak and all of the intense pressure that it's putting on our health systems and all of the significant damage that it's causing to the health of people in our communities. But that doesn't mean that we need to stop thinking about other health challenges that are continuing to go on throughout this time. Our systems need to be strong enough and have enough capacity not only to handle the COVID-19 outbreak, but also all the other health needs that affect people in our population.
But Professor Gable, right now we're seeing the full force of what the government can do. I think this is under the law. I mean, that's, if we're having a civilized society, we are supposed to be living under the rule of law. So how much authority does the government have during these circumstances? How is that throttled up, and who gets to tap the brakes? I mean, what's really going on here legal-wise?
Well, the government has quite a lot of authority to respond to situations like we're facing right now. So if you have a dangerous infectious disease outbreak that we don't have effective treatments for yet, and we don't have effective vaccinations for yet. It's a situation where the only immediately effective way to stop the spread of this disease that is going to pose a great deal of risk to lots of people is to put in place rules that require people to stay apart from each other for a period of time. And the government has a lot of authority to do this. Most of the power for this is actually in the hands of the state government. So states around the country, governors have authority under state law to implement a whole wide range of different kinds of provisions to keep people apart from each other. That can be in the form of some of these social separation orders, orders to close businesses and to suspend gatherings and events. It can extend to specific quarantine or isolation orders for specific individuals. You know, isolation would be for people who are actually diagnosed as infected with the COVID-19 virus, and quarantine would be people who have been exposed to people who are infected. And so all of these powers are within the scope of government power. In addition to the powers of social separation and individual quarantine and isolation, there are also our powers that the government has to control property. So that would be some of the property closure orders, but also even to the extent of using property to expand the capacity of our healthcare systems. So if we need extra hospital capacity, extra beds, extra resources to be produced, like personal protective equipment, all those are things that are within the authority of the government to require those actions to happen.
Now, Dr. Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist, you're a stress expert. Hearing that the government has a lot of authority, that they are locking down businesses, people are told they can't go to work, they're very uncertain about what their economic future is, or not to mention what their health future is. How would you put the scale, you know, if we had to have a 1 to 10 scale of people's stress, and typically on a normal day, maybe it's at a 7, I guess, or 6. Right now, where do you think it mostly is for a lot of folks?
So our data suggests that people's typical stress is somewhere in the 5 area, right, on a 1 to 10. So I'm suspecting most people are in that 7 to 8 range right now because there is so much uncertainty. For most people, it feels like there's a lot of things that are out of their control and they don't really know what to expect next. And those are the kinds of things that drive our level of stress, that uncertainty, the ambiguity, the fact that coronavirus really is an invisible threat, and the idea that we don't know how long we may be sheltering in place, staying at home, on lockdown, whatever the language is that's being used, and when we'll be able to return to our usual state of affairs. And then it's quadrupled in many ways for the people who have children at home with them, who are concerned about school, or who are not able to work right now and are really facing, you know, significant loss of income, if not bankruptcy, and really tremendous changes in their economic well-being.
So I'm taking the philosophical point of view. Some people will say, you know, certainty has always been an illusion or a delusion, but it's an illusion or delusion that I love. And it's great to have that because it does make you feel like you're going to get through all of this. So how do we tell people to find some level of certainty in the life where there is a lot of turbulence?
Yeah, we want to have people try to do two things. One is to figure out ways to deal with the anxiety and stress that they're feeling so that they can then look at what are the things they actually do have some control over and can they make some plans for how they might proceed, even if it's just for that day, because that helps people feel a little more certainty about what to expect next and some sense of the direction they're headed in and how they might manage.
Our number again, if you want to call in with your questions or comments, how are you dealing with this uncertainty? Are you feeling a lot of stress? How are you? Are you practicing some mindfulness to try to bring you down and relax a little bit? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-877-8255. Back to you, Professor Gable, law professor, talking about the legal framework for what's happening right now. One thing I always wonder about is habeas corpus. You know, provide the body? You know, if a person is in quarantine, does that mean habeas corpus is suspended?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, it's important to remember that even under these restrictive orders that states have the authority to put into place, it doesn't mean that individual rights and liberties go away. You know, we have substantial protections for freedom of movement that are protected under the Constitution, but they can be restricted under certain circumstances. And so if a person is put under a quarantine order and that quarantine order is meant to last for a particular period of time, or it's dependent on certain symptoms or certain other evaluations, maybe if there's a test available to determine whether someone has not been infected and has been separated for, you know, beyond a certain number of days, you know, those kinds of restrictions can be challenged. A person could try to file a legal challenge, a rights-based challenge against that quarantine order. And then a court would have to evaluate whether the quarantine order was legitimate. And the way they would do that is they would look to see if the use of the government's power to restrict the person's movement was grounded in science. Was there a compelling interest in that the government met, and was it narrowly tailored to meet that interest? And so what that means in practice is that if there's evidence that supports quarantining a person for a period of time or a group of people for a period of time, and the government can prove through introduction of evidence that it's a compelling interest of the government to do so, then they're likely to win. And in a situation like this, where there's a widespread disease that is infecting people throughout the community, the government has a very strong case. If they were to abuse these powers and say, keep people locked down for a far greater time than the science supported, or impose this on people, for example, if people had already recovered from the disease, and while we're still trying to figure out how this works scientifically, if we find out, for example, that people who've had the coronavirus and have recovered have immunity and can't be infected again, then it would be inappropriate to continue to keep those people under a quarantine order because they no longer pose a threat of being infected or infecting others. And so that's the kind of fact that would call into question, a very broad-based quarantine policy, and individuals could challenge it on that basis. And so there's a balancing that has to be done between the government power and individual liberties. And in this case, in most circumstances right now, the government's argument is going to be the one that prevails. As time goes on, that could change depending on what happens.
Right, but I wonder about the burden of proof. So I have my comic book store. The city says, you got to shut down, you're non-essential. But I say, I don't have COVID-19 in my store. None of my employees have it. We make sure we wipe down all the surfaces. We check everybody who comes in. We check their temperature. We are a COVID-19 free comic book store, yet I have to shut down. It seems like, is the burden of proof on me or on the city to make sure that I have to shut down?
Well, if the city is issuing the order, that order is going to go into effect. If you want to challenge it, the burden would be on the city to provide evidence that the widespread order was warranted, or the order with respect to you was warranted. Given the factors on the ground right now, the city is going to have an easy time proving that because
the upper hand,
the widespread nature and the way that they totally do. And that's likely to be the case for a dangerous disease like this one in almost every circumstance. I think there would only be very limited kinds of circumstances where an individual would be able to successfully challenge an order under these circumstances.
And we're getting ready to come up onto a break. But when we come back, I want to ask you more about, as we move through this process and maybe we start going towards the other side, how do we make sure that these powers are put back in the bottle where they belong? And sometimes there's a history behind all of this. Typhoid Mary is a name that comes up. Also, sometimes governments have used these powers with racist intent, and we can talk about that as well. The phone number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're also going to keep talking about healthy ways to manage anxiety, stress, and loneliness while stuck at home. What have you found most helpful in coping during these uncertain times? You can call in. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. We're also on Facebook, and you can email us at the source. thesource at tpr.org. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Businesses have been ordered to shut down. People have been told to shelter in place. In some extreme cases, there are mandatory quarantines. But where does this come from? What is the legal framework that allows all this to happen? The mayor has a press conference, tells people to shut down. But what is his legal authority to do that? Well, there's a lot of law and history behind that. Still, we have to find a balance between public health, safety, and civil liberties. What are your rights during a quarantine? What are the implications for constitutional rights such as freedom of movement and travel? What is the legal framework for all of these powers? And also, simultaneously, how do you maintain your psychological well-being while all of this is going on? A lot of stress is happening. How do you manage that anxiety and loneliness while you are ordered to stay at home? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255-833-TPR-TALK. And I have a question here. Let's go to the phones with Jenny. And Jenny, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to share a perspective that maybe it's a little bit hard to access for a lot of people right now, and that's gratitude. I just feel like, you know, I know that there are people around the world that are in much worse circumstances than we are in India and in Italy. And we really have so much around us to be grateful for. I don't see quite the need for such fear and anxiety and panic. I mean, I just think it's an opportunity to look around and go, hey, you know, how much have I complained about not being able to spend enough time with my family? How much have I, you know, maybe wanted to work from home? How much, you know, have I wanted to have groceries or takeout delivered to my door? You know, I feel like the authorities are doing everything that they can, and that this is a time to kind of really step back and go, okay, you know, we have a lot to be grateful for. You know, the HEBs are open. The delivery drivers like myself, please tip us, by the way, sorry. But, you know, we're here to help. We're here to get everything that you need to you. And the authorities are doing what they can in terms of, you know, the healthcare needs, you know, and there's so many, you know, 99% of us aren't sick, you know, and, you know, there, I think that this, you know, keeping people at home is a good idea, but there's just a lot to be grateful for.
All right, Jenny, thank you so much. Gratitude for your call. And I'm going to go to Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist, stress expert, and she is associate executive director for practice research and policy at the American Psychological Association. I hear a lot about keeping a gratitude journal. And at first when I heard that, I thought that was kind of like, you know, kind of tofu, happy, wappy talk. But now the more I think about it, the more research I've done into it, I see that it does have a lot of benefits.
Oh, absolutely. Remembering what we have to be grateful for really does help us balance sort of our tendency at times when we feel under stress to go towards the worst and the negative. And as Jenny mentioned, we have, and most people in this country have a lot to be grateful for, particularly relative to people in other parts of the world. But that's not to diminish that there are some people who are really going to be deeply impacted by all of this, people who are losing their jobs and all of that. But if we can continue to look at some of the positives that we may be experiencing, even if they're small moments, connected with my mom in a new way because we weren't able to be together face-to-face, but we shared our love of a book together, and that was wonderful. Or the opportunity to, I actually see in my neighborhood, I feel it in my neighborhood, the air is cleaner because there's so much less traffic on the roads. Wow, that's really wonderful that that's a positive benefit for that, and that helps my overall well-being to be able to recognize that in the midst of feeling uncertain about what's going to happen next.
But on the same side, you know, I got to talk about being Pollyanna, you know, happy that the air is cleaner, but also there's a lot of people who are out of work, and we're probably on, we're looking at a tsunami of a lot of really bad stuff coming.
We are. And you know, those who have the capability to do something to support their neighbors who are going to be deeply impacted, strongly encourage you to think about how you can do that right now, because this is about a community. The quarantines, the isolation is about trying to promote community health and community well-being. And it's a wonderful opportunity for us to think about what does it mean to be part of a community and how can we engage in a way that's going to be productive. It doesn't mean that positive thinking is going to make everything better, but it can help our mental outlook, which then enables us to make some decisions and perhaps with a little more clear-headedness about what our options are.
Let's go to another caller, and this is Carol. And Carol, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm excited to be on the air.
We're excited to have you.
Carol Elliott, and I'm a professional musician. And the reason I'm calling in is because yesterday I was at Central Market waiting in line to be allowed in, and a musician named Joe Posada set up his equipment and played his saxophone and flute along with some pre-recorded music. And as soon as he started playing, you could just see people's shoulders dropping and relaxing. And so my positive thing to contribute today is to encourage people, if you're already a musician, take this free time to practice and learn new songs and share them, you know, with yourself if you need it, or anyone else in your household. If you don't have an instrument, go use your CD player or your iPod, or I even have old albums that I play, and take lots of deep breaths and listen to music. And I used to be a street singer in San Francisco, so it really, I loved seeing Joe out there doing that, and I may even call Central Market myself and see if I can get a slot.
All right, Carol, thank you for that call. So Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist, the power of music, it can soothe the savage beast, and it can also bring us off the ledge.
Oh, it certainly can. There's been some beautiful videos shared around the world of singers in Italy standing on their balconies in their apartment complexes and singing opera. It's been amazingly gorgeous. It really does help us see some beauty in times when we might be finding a hard time of finding it. It doesn't diminish the reality of the situations that we're in, but it also underscores that we share something across. So it's a way of getting connected to people, even if we're not physically next to them, by sharing something in common that underscores our humanity and our common interests.
Now, over to Professor Lance Gable, law professor at Wayne State University, internationally expert on public health law and bioethics. I want to bring up Typhoid Mary. Typhoid Mary was an actual individual, turn-of-the-century Irish cook around New York City, who was asymptomatic of typhoid fever and was infecting dozens of people, and she persisted. She refused to stop working as a cook, and she continued to expose others to the disease. And she was twice forced into isolation by the police there, public health officials, onto an island in that area in order to keep her from infecting people. And that's sort of held up as an example of what the law can do. In today's day and age, are we still looking at that same legal framework to order people, you have to be on Lackland Air Force Base because you were on the Princess Cruise Line, and we have to make sure that you are not going to spread coronavirus to the general population?
Well, the legal powers that are in place do still permit those kinds of government restrictions. And so as long as the government can demonstrate that kind of restriction on a person's movement is necessary to protect the public, then that kind of order can be upheld as valid. I think where you get into some challenges is when you're talking about imposing that kind of restriction on thousands or even millions of people, not based on a specific designation that a particular individual is a risk to the public, but that social movement in general right now is a risk to spreading this disease because we haven't gotten a handle on it yet. And I think when we think about what's likely to happen or what could happen in the future with the application of these government powers, that's something to keep in mind. So, I can foresee a future if we manage to get our act together and make available widespread testing for this disease. And we're able to actually offer testing, and anyone who wants to get a test to see if they're infected can get that test. Then once we know everyone's infection status, we can be a lot more targeted in how we implement these social distancing and quarantine measures. We won't be necessary or even justifiable to lock everyone down if we can quickly determine whether someone is actually infected with this disease or not. There might be some shorter term restrictions that would be applicable to make sure someone didn't develop it over a period of time. But we could use that testing process to more closely understand scientifically what a person's risk is, and then we could actually have a much more targeted approach. And I think that's a goal we should be striving for. We can't do it right now, though, because we don't have the capacity. And so
sure.
For the time being, these more widespread broad orders are not only probably practically appropriate, but they're also legally supported.
Now, but at around the same time, there was a cholera outbreak in San Francisco. The city officials in San Francisco ordered all the Chinese in a particular neighborhood, a population there, to be tested for cholera, but they did not ask the Anglo population to be tested. That went all the way to the Supreme Court, and that ruled that you cannot use race-based as a way to who gets tested and who doesn't. So you can't use race in this sort of type of circumstance?
Well, sure. So if any of these policies, any of these powers are being used in a way that is only targeted to a particular racial group or only targeted in a way that impacts a particular group, and that can be supported through evidence that there's some underlying discriminatory pretext for doing that, then a court would throw out that authority as being an unconstitutional application. And so
there are some limits on what the government can do in these areas. They have to say you have to. So there are some rules. It's not just a pell-mell, tabula rasa. They can do whatever they want. There are some ways to protect some civil liberties in this time of pandemic. We got to take a break. Our phone lines are open. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're discussing individual rights during this public health crisis, also how you can cope during this stressful time. And you can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. And let's go to a caller. And this is Stephen Shepard, the Dean of the Law School at St. Mary's School of Law. And Dean Shepard, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, sir.
Well, I'm grateful for all the work that you and the team at TPR are putting in. I think that you're doing a great job, not only of keeping us entertained, but keeping us informed, and also, as you were saying, talking about important issues like you always do. I know the time is tight. I just wanted to help frame an answer to the question you asked about where does the power come from and how does it work with rights? And if you think carefully about the Constitution you learned about as a kid, the 13 states created the federal Constitution and delegated some of their powers to the new central government, but then later, not long later, adopted a Bill of Rights to limit those powers. And those rights looked like a lot of the rights that had already been recognized by the states. Well, some of the rights and some of the powers the states had that they did not entirely delegate are called police powers. Today, we think of the police as just police officers because they enforce mainly criminal law, but we still have a residual understanding of this in places like the title of the county judge. The state's powers of police are over the health, safety, and welfare of the citizenry. And they're called plenary powers. They're not inherently limited. And so it was always the responsibility in England of the king, through the sheriffs, the representatives of the king, to put down quarantines, to isolate people who were dangerous to themselves and others, even if they weren't criminals. The necessity of ensuring that the people are safe and secure is essential for keeping a government at all, much less the law. And the law has limits on those. Professor Dable is talking about those limits, and you've been talking about those limits, because the rights that have been put in place to fairness, to right of due process, to ensure that not only legislatively but through executive power, the plenary power of police jurisdiction over health, safety, welfare, and all of the things that are necessary for us to live as a community and individuals, that those can't be abused. So the courts are always supposed to be vigilant in protecting individual rights, but still the power of the mayor, the power of the governor, the power of the county judge, those are the police powers of the state. They've been there since before the founding of the United States, and the states still have them.
But the Public Health Service Act passed in 1944, this is when they really was the first time that the U.S. Public Health Service was given responsibility for preventing the introduction, transmission, and spread of diseases throughout the United States, particularly with a focus on coming from foreign countries. But they, you know, all this stuff has to be spelled out and worked out through Congress and put in black and white, right?
Well, yes and no.
Not necessarily Congress.
The powers that are in play in the Public Health Act are those where the federal government has unique authority over the problems that are caused by international and interstate travel.
Okay, I want to get Professor Lance Gable back. You were saying, sir?
Yes.
So the points are all well taken. I mean, the powers that exist at the federal level are limited to certain types of authority. So keeping diseases outside the country, having quarantine powers over people who are entering from other countries, and potentially stopping the spread between states. Those are powers that would exist at the federal level, but the states retain power to control and prevent the spread of disease within their own borders, and those are the police powers that the dean was just talking about a minute ago. And so the kinds of specific descriptions of how those powers can be put into place, those are contained in state law, in public health codes, and they can also be changed not only by the legislature, but in times of emergency. There can be executive orders by a governor at the state level, or potentially by a president at the federal level, to try to more rapidly respond to these kinds of emergencies.
Now, I'm going to swing back over to Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist. Now, we're kind of getting, I really love talking about the law and this kind of a nerdy part of the whole thing. But I think this is also, it has some stress relief benefits as well. Knowing exactly what is going on, knowing what is the legal framework, how does this happen, and what it gives you an idea what could be going on moving forward. Does that have some benefit psychologically?
Sure. It's an interesting question. All of us desire perhaps a different amount of information. For some people, they really like to know, here's what to expect, here's what I can anticipate. Others want to know sort of, here's what I need to know right now. So for individuals, it's important to understand what best helps you manage uncertainty and then seek out that level of information. I'm one of those people who likes to know a lot, so it's really helpful for me to understand what the limits are, how broad things can be, what's likely to happen. I have family members who really want to know, what do they need to know right now, and they'll deal with that information. So yes, it can be helpful, but we also need to think individually about how much information is useful to us to manage our stress. And it becomes particularly important when you live with others, because you might have different needs in that regard. So having a sense of what you need and what the other people in your house need is important, because that can help determine the kinds of conversations you have and how much the news is on or not.
Now, so Professor Lance Gable, I really want to know, what are the limits that the government has in these circumstances?
Do you mean the limits in terms of just keeping people socially separated, or the limits just in what the government can do more broadly?
I'm concerned about abuse. I'm concerned about maybe some people in the government maybe canceling elections. We're getting a lot of questions about, can the presidential election be suspended or canceled even? Are there people in government who can use this to profit or to bolster themselves up, grab more power, and refuse to give it up in the end?
Well, our system has built into it some robust checks and balances that are designed to prevent against those kinds of abuses of power. Now, they haven't always been successful throughout history, but I think there are many mechanisms in place that can limit the abuse of some of these powers. You know, the primary mechanism has got to be the judiciary, in the sense that these orders and the use of these powers can be challenged in court. And the judiciary can overrule government actions that are either unconstitutional or otherwise in violation of the law because they're abusing power. So that's one check. Legislatures have a check on executive power as well, and so they have control over funds that are authorized, and then the public as well. We need to be paying attention to what our leaders are doing. If we find these orders or the use of these powers to be inappropriate, we need to make that known to them and really make our voices heard. So those are all ways that we can kind of push back against these kinds of abuses of power. And sharing information, understanding the limits of the powers in the first place, can help us to understand when that pressure needs to be applied.
So, Professor Gable, it seems like initially, right now, there is an abundance of goodwill in the society. People are willing to accept certain sacrifices, although I'm not willing to sacrifice my life or anyone for the good of the stock market, but I'm willing to do what I can for society right now by staying home or seeing what we can do. But that's gonna run out. That's gonna peter out, and then people will be looking for legal remedies to see what can happen. So is that what you expect, that we may start seeing some challenges here?
I expect that we will see challenges like this, especially as time goes on. And there's actually a way to make that less likely, or at least make the social separation less harmful to people, and that can be accomplished through law as well. And so if Congress and if our state legislatures are willing to make some modifications to our social safety net to make it more robust, to help people who, to give them money to help make ends meet, to prevent people from being evicted when they can't pay their rent, there are a number of other things that could be really, to expand access to health insurance and other kinds of health care support. All of these things are things that the government can do right now that would allow people to not face so much pressure by being separated, and also make it more likely that people will actually comply with these separation orders and allow us to get to the other side of it without more damage being done to the health of the population.
So will a federal judge be looking at, like, you can maintain social distancing and isolation and the pandemic, but that doesn't mean you have to totally and sacrifice individual rights. We try and figure out a way to do both, correct?
Correct. I mean, it is a balancing between the two things. Our goals in protecting the health of the community and making sure that people stay apart do need to be balanced against those individual rights and the circumstances that individuals are facing. Under our current conditions, those population needs are particularly strong. The individual rights don't go away. They still exist. And ultimately, when challenges arise, it will be up to the courts to try to balance those two considerations.
Yeah, and so just really, really quick, and in regards to elections, there are other ways to have elections than an in-person voting. So that's something that we'll probably be hearing a lot about.
Absolutely, and that's something that that Congress can weigh in on as well.
So mail-in ballots or something else.
To ensure that mail-in ballots are available nationwide, and that could be enacted through legislation. Individual states can also take steps proactively on their own to make sure that there is access to mail-in ballots for everyone who's eligible to vote.
All right, so I got to let you go. Law professor at Wayne State University, Professor Lance Gable, thank you so much for coming on air with us today. Also, Lynn Bufka, clinical psychologist, and she is the Associate Executive Director for Practice Research and Policy at the American Psychological Association. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.
Thank you.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.